This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network podcast. My name is Katie Coldiron, and I'm based at Florida International University in Miami, Florida. And I have the great pleasure today to be interviewing the authors of The Dissidents of Reynaldo Arenas, Queering Literature, Politics, and the Activist Curriculum, released in 2022 from the University Press of Florida. The three authors of this work that I have here today are Sandro Bajos, who is assistant professor in the Curriculum Instruction and Teacher Education Program at Michigan State University, and also the author of Competing Truths in Latin American Literature, Narrating Otherness and Marginality; Rafael Acacio, the Charles A. Dana Professor of Spanish at Agnes Scott College, who's the author of two additional books on Reynaldo Arenas, which are Reynaldo Arenas, Cuba's Political and Sexual Outlaw, and The Making of a Gay Activist. And finally, the third author here today on the podcast with us is Angela L. Willis, who is the professor of Hispanic Studies and Latin American Studies at Davidson College. She is also the author of several studies on queer Cuban writers and on the picturesque novel. So welcome to the podcast today, Sandro, Rafael, and Angela.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Katie.
So just to start out, usually I like to begin asking how this project came to be. So where there are three of you, I really would like to hear from each of you of how each of you personally became involved with this project.
Well, that's an interesting question, and I will take charge of it because I have been working with Reynaldo for several years now, and I felt that there was something left unsaid. And I thought that there was going to be another book, but I did not want to write it by myself. So I reached out to two of my best friends, Angie and Sandro, and we came up with this idea of doing a multi-disciplinary book that looks at Reynaldo from various angles, from the literary angle, from the political angle. And also, we wanted to look at Reynaldo as a way to learn how to do queer activism. And that's where Sandro comes. We wanted to highlight that Reynaldo from day one was a teacher. And the three of us learned so many things from him in so many different ways.
Thank you so much for that. So I'd like to hear from you, Angela, as well, what kind of motivated you after being asked by Rafael to participate to follow through with this project?
Yeah, so it was an incredible honor to be invited by this eminent Iranian scholar to participate in the collaborative way on the project. For us, Rafael has been a mentor for both me and Sandro. I like to share that I met him truly at one of my first academic conferences ever. And he came up, introduced himself, and started telling me about other sources. And this was back in the day before we also readily used electronic sources. He told me about some things I should read. And lo and behold, a week later, they were in my mailbox. And that is the kind of mentor that he has been to me for the last 20 years plus. So when he reached out and extended the invitation, it was a wonderful opportunity. And I did not know Sandro, and we became fast friends as well. And I would also like to share that during the height of the COVID quarantine, this project was an intellectual lifeline that brought us together. We went from barely using Skype to being Zoom experts. And we had met in person only once, the three of us, in March of 2020, the exact week everything shut down. And then we had a recent reunion in Atlanta, which was really exciting. So I'll let Sandro tell you more about the process, but it was really truly a collaborative experience.
Samesies for me. For me, of course, it's very interesting to note that it all goes back to Rafa. And for the simple reason that his work in Reinaldo Arenas was actually part of my dissertation. And I think I mentioned somewhere, and we met, I mean, I think a decade later after I had defended and my dissertation. And it was during a Posse Foundation, which is a group that, mentors and sort of receives a sort of first generation college students mostly. And we were both participating on the training, and I saw his name, and this is like, and then I asked, are you the Rafael Ocasio who writes? Okay, you were on my dissertation, you know? And I think he might have felt legendary by then, which it means he felt very old, but it's true. It's a work of mentorship. And it's very interesting how coming back to Arenas is also making you think about who are your mentors. Who are your teachers and, you know, people that you don't even meet, you know, and who later become your teachers, you know? So I think that this is my bit to sort of see how this project came about. I think it came about foremost because of Rafa's incredible invitation and also the open-mindedness and open-heartedness with which, you know, we all have different, I think I locate Rafa's work very much into the historiographic level, you know, and you can sense that thread in the book. Angela's very much as a literary critic and a literary scholar in that sense. And me, I come from education and, you know, more so in public pedagogy, which is sort of this theoretical concept we use to focus on forms, sites of education that occur beyond schooling. So literary spaces, activist spaces are things that interest me very much. So, and it's very interesting how people from sort of different walks of life and different interests always find, you know, their mentors, not necessarily within the same discipline, but, you know, across disciplines. So, yeah.
Thank you so much for that from all three of you. And I really do like within this book and your at the very beginning, you talk about your personal relationships with the work of Reinaldo Arenas, and then in your case, Rafael Reinaldo Arenas, the person. So moving on, obviously, Reinaldo Arenas is a hugely important figure for anyone trying to understand revolutionary Cuba or even the Cuban exile. But obviously, there might be those listening to this podcast that don't know who Reinaldo Arenas is. So my first question for one of you is, who was Reinaldo Arenas?
Well, in a nutshell, it will be very difficult to define who Reinaldo Arenas is, was, and will be. So let's start with the was. I will describe Reinaldo as among the first Latin American writers who in the 1960s was developing what we would call later queer literature. His development as a writer goes hand in hand with his development as a queer individual. And the literature for the 1960s was very daring within the Latin American literary frame. He was also an activist, and you mentioned the Cuban Revolution, so we cannot separate the two of them. Reynaldo Arenas owes a lot to the Cuban Revolution in the sense that he became a writer because of several projects that the revolution had placed had put in place for the development of literature. However, the revolution was not very much into queer activism, and that's where Reynaldo breaks away from the Cuban Revolution. So what will Reynaldo Arenas be when we will write the history of the Cuban Revolution? I don't know, when would that be? Would it be after the fall of communism in Cuba? But whenever that day will be, Reynaldo Arenas should be placed as among the most important writers and activists that come from this background, a political movement that changed the history of Cuba. And we can also say that it changed the history of Latin America as a whole, and including the United States.
Thank you so much, Rafael. I think it's really interesting, too, that you point out kind of what Reynaldo Arenas will be, because you do at the very end of the book point out that Reynaldo Arenas is not a figure whose work is openly read in Cuba. It is in official spaces prohibited. So it'll be very interesting to see when and if the communist system does fall in Cuba. Will he be reintroduced or not? So kind of moving into the meat of the book, my next question is focused on the first chapter, which largely addresses Arenas's political activism from exile through sharing his experiences as, testimonial within revolutionary Cuba, which you classify as public pedagogy. Could one of you elaborate a bit more on this and specifically how it is reflected in his writing?
Ooh, I love this question. Looks like, it looks like one of those, sounds like one of those doctoral exam questions, Kudos, I'll take that one then. I think that when we conventionally think about pedagogy, we are taught to think of pedagogy as something that happens inside classroom walls, right? And done by people who are institutionally positioned as teachers, within the structures of school. And that is one way of looking at it. Because my work comes from public pedagogy, I think it's something that we discussed a lot, I tend to see literature as a site of education as well. So in this focus on forms and process of learning that happens outside, not necessarily within schools, but outside schooling and have practices, I kind of came to this idea, look, I see him as a public pedagogue in the sense that this is a guy that is teaching sort of counter histories, that do not accommodate easily to either the United States version of what the Cuban Revolution should mean, nor what the Cubans themselves wanted the Cuban Revolution to be. There's these demands on uniformity, easy answers, lack of poetry, hence the favorite realist sort of aesthetics of the Cuban regime. And at the same time, the United States wanted this sort of idealized version of the world, romanticized even, that he was not able to provide. He was somebody who was teaching very much how complicated it was to live in the midst of history and how language, realist language, was limited in telling folks about the quote-unquote reality, the lived experience of that reality. So in that sense, he was sort of this pedagogue, this teacher that was sort of introducing to audiences, these alternative views of what does it mean to live in the ambiguities of historical processes, to be caught between these two oppositional forces that are much more complicated, much more complex than one would think. And I had learned from another teacher, Rafa, the sort of like these sort of tensions. And so I wanted to pick up and sort of like run and propose perhaps this focus on these resistant aspects of his book writing as a form of public pedagogy, mindful that every, for us, at least, you know, in public pedagogy in general, pedagogy, every communicative act is a pedagogical act. Every act that we do towards communicating something is teaching somebody about something about us or about the world that is around us. So that's kind of like the focus that I was trying to bring in, and I hope I answered the question. You know, it's sort of like multiplying in many ways the meaning of what the teacher is as a figure.
Yes, you very much did answer my question, Sandro. Thank you so much. And I do really like that you point out how Renato Arenas didn't really fit in any real, you know, strict paradigm of, you know, Cold War U.S. versus Cuba. I think more than anything, he advocated, you know, his personal freedom to not only live outside of the communist system, but also to be able to express his gender and sexuality in the way that he so desired and felt. So moving on to the second chapter, which focuses largely on Arenas' identity as a Marielito, which is means someone who came to left Cuba during the 1980 Mariel boat lift and came to Florida. And he was also a Marielito who was openly gay at that. So could one of you tell me a bit about how Arenas navigated these identities once in exile, and also about his participation in the documentary film Conducta Impropia?
The importance of Reinaldo Arenas coming through the Mariel boat lift in 1980 is huge. Reinaldo at the time had developed a huge name in Europe, mainly in France, where not only he had won literary prizes for his novels translated into French, but he was also on his way to become the activist that we know today. For the most part, those people who know about Reinaldo will remember his last 10 years of the United States. He came, as I said, in 1980, and he died in 1990. What's important of this time period is that Reinaldo, once he arrived in the United States, he remained by choice, a Marielito. Reinaldo Arenas, with the reputation, with the literary reputation that he had, he could have very well ignored that he came through this boat lift. The boat lift was very important, and many political activists will say that President Carter lost the elections in part because of he's allowing the boat lift to take place. Over 150,000 Cubans came to the United States in a matter of maybe 3-4 months. Among them, and this is the controversial part, among them were criminals or people with criminal records. They were petty criminal records. And Reinaldo Arenas had also a criminal record, and homosexuals. And this was the first time that the United States legally, diplomatically, didn't know how to handle the fact that they were among those people, homosexuals. And again, Reinaldo decided to remain throughout his 10 years in the United States, a Marielito. I always have said that Reinaldo knew that his staying as a Marielito would damage his reputation. I think that's one of the reasons why not many more people know about Reinaldo or take him as someone with a minor stature than other Cuban writers who came to the United States or to Europe at various different time periods. He was also, as you mentioned, he was also involved in conducta impropia. Often when critics look at the development of the Cuban Revolution in relation to their acceptance or not of homosexuality, they will point to a period in which there were a series of police raids that led to the that took people to work camps. And that's what Conducta Impropia is looking into. The documentary is still very well examined as an example of the Cuban Revolution ways in which homosexuals were not immediately accepted as proper citizens. And I think Angie will later talk a little bit more about Conducta Impropia because the director and Reynaldo had a very close relationship.
Most definitely. Angie, if you'd like to go ahead and expand on that a little bit, because I know in the text you all mentioned that Reynaldo was a really key part of this documentary even coming to be, much less, you know, him being in the film himself.
Sure. I was going to talk a little bit later about the relationship of what we refer to in the book as a group of enfants terribles, which was comprised of Spanish writer Juan Goytisolo, Néstor Almendros, and Arenas, amongst others, which again, I can elaborate on that a little bit more later, but it was really, really interesting to find out in our archival research at Princeton University, where Arenas's papers and manuscripts are held, that there is a there are letters. There's a letter from Almendros to Arenas, and there is a letter from Goytisolo to Arenas. In the book, we discuss a relationship, personal relationships, professional relationships amongst these queer, exiled, creative geniuses, right, who were working on the fringes, working on the margins, trying to bring about social justice politically, sexually, and otherwise. And this connects again with, as Rafa was talking about, with the boat, Mar del boat exodus, and a lot of the Cubans who came out of Cuba at that time.
Thank you so much for that. So moving on to the third chapter, which focuses largely on Arenas's attempts to what you all call rewrite Cuban history through the lens of his own experiences, as well as in a sense to write that history into how he thought it should have played out. Could one of you tell us a bit more about this phenomenon?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Katie. I'll take that one too. That's a topic that really touches me and runs throughout my research. Something that's really amazing about Arenas is that his stories are both universal. They speak to so many different parts of the human experience at the same time that they're very much his own and they're very Cuban. But something that I find over and over in his work is that he had an obvious fascination with rewriting existing literary traditions, forms, and genres, which is super interesting when we think about how he was such a dissident and such a rebel, but he would use pre-existing forms to W-R-I-T-E stories at the same thing that the same time that he was R-I-G-H-T, rewriting history, right? I actually teach a class on that exact topic on rewriting history through rewriting. He, for example, takes Latin American stories and queers them, remolding them so that we can find a different perspective, a different story. And for example, his parodic rewriting of the 19th century abolitionist novel Cecilia Valdez by Cirilo Villaverde, which Arenas retitled as La Loma del Ángel, which in fact is the subtitle of Villaverde's masterpiece, he moves the periphery to the center. In the end of that novel, the slaves, the mulattoes, the secondary characters, like the subtitle, moved to occupy spaces that had been denied to them before. And another example, in El Mundo Alucinante, which was probably his most famous novel, smuggled out of Cuba and by the Camachos, his patrons, published in 1969, he rewrites the story of 18th, 19th century Mexican independence leader Fray Servando Teresa de Mier's memoirs, who was a dissident fighting against colonial oppression right? He rewrites the story as his own. He makes it into a multi-perspective text, which at times is autobiographical. And this was the novel that in large part got him in trouble with the Cuban regime, because he had it published in France, first in French, without the Castro regime's permission. And reading through the lines, through the metaphor, you see that he was speaking out against oppression, authoritarianism, writ large. So again, that's something that he does over and over and over, which is really interesting.
Thank you
so
much.
There are a lot more examples, Katie, but I want to make sure you get to everybody here.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. No, it's really, really a fascinating thing and really kind of challenges, you know, kind of preconceived notions of truth and history and whatnot. So it's really fascinating to hear about. So the fourth chapter talks a lot about, you know, hierarchies of information and the melding of past and present in the work of Arenas. So I'd love to hear a bit more from one of you about this phenomenon and how it's present in Arenas's literary works.
Okay, first of all, these questions are delicious. And I'm like stealing them and rewording them and doing my Arenas thing on graduate exams, because they are really thoughtful. I'll take this one rather briefly. One thing that is fascinating to us, and something that I discussed with both Rafa and Angie, is this problematizing of the historical nation. You know, it's like, what is fiction and what is not, is such a, cultural historians, I think, would not have a problem with it, right? It's more for this multiplicity of points of views and so forth. But certain segments of the more hardcore social science-y type of field, show me the evidence, the hard evidence, might have a problem with it. And in many ways, I think that these differences are to be lived with, and not necessarily, you know, they're unresolved. We need to learn how to live with this and keep the conversation going on. But I wanted to sort of like understand, well, if you understand the life of Reinaldo as a public pedagogue, as a teacher, and here is, you know, what he's teaching, what about his curriculum, his life, his lived experiences as a curriculum? What would it be like to approach it like that? So, for us, it was a matter of delving into, well, what do we understand by curriculum, right? So people say, it's the organization of a history and this, of a subject worth knowing, and this is what the Cuban Revolution wants you to learn, and this is what the United States wants you to learn about Cuba, and here's Reinaldo telling you that is totally not reality, you know? And yet being so convincing when we know that there's a lot of factual inaccuracies in his narratives, even if we take a historical approach and say the same account that appears in his autobiography, which is a genre that we, you know, it's problematic in his own terms, but, you know, it's like, oh, here it is, you know, I spent 3 days on the top of a tree, whatever, 4 days sleeping on the right, hiding from the police, you know, and other testimonial accounts grounded that is like that had never happened, and his propensity to get into trouble with people, you know, he was an acerbic person that exercised his truth, you know, in a very Parisiastes sort of way, you know, I am fearless and I'm going to speak my truth, and if you don't like it, too bad. So for us in this chapter was to basically think about his literature as a curriculum. So what is, and if curriculum is this very complicated idea of what information matters most and why, curriculum is essentially not necessarily a guarantee that you are going to learn something, but that you're going to be oriented toward things that you may not have been oriented in the past. This matters too. This queerness matters too. This ambiguity matters too. And then it was an issue of, okay, how might we tell this story? And then conversing, you know, with my colleagues, which is like, well, in curriculum theory, there's this shift that happens in the 1970s, 1975, that curriculum starts to be proposed as coming from the lived experiences of students, right? So what if we use this sort of theoretical, idea and use it as a heuristic to read Reinaldo Arenas as a curriculum? So, you know, I had been interested in the past in the work of a educational scholar, curriculum scholar, William Pienaar, who now teaches at the University of British Columbia, but has been one of the historical figures, also a queer author in many ways, in this shifting of a curriculum to account for the lived experience of students. And so he devised these four steps, you know, that for us served as a heuristic to analyze Arenas's lived experience curriculum, you know, in a regressive sort of way, and how he does that in a progressive, in other words, how he imagines the future. And then there's narratives of this future that is always present, right? In Arenas, even when Arenas writes about futuristic events, like any dystopian author, is never really about the future. It's about the present that is already here and is just transposed. So that's what is the beauty of it. And then, you know, how he synthesizes all these things. So the four steps, the progressive, the regressive, the synthetic, and the analytical, served as a heuristic to sort of enter to this understanding of how information is hierarchized, right? How past and present, you know, are really about the present, modifying the past in many, many ways. So Reinaldo has many studies about the role of memory in his literature. La Escritura de la Memoria is one that comes to mind. So this sort of allowed us to talk about even his more futuristic sort of accounts, you know, fiction, and in a way that accounts for this importance of the present, which reinforces this idea that he had a very, what I discussed with my colleagues as well, this very phenomenological look at the world, where there's this beautiful quote that when I needed, they are very good at locating stuff of Arenas. I just use Arenas to do my own thing, but like they're very good. It was like, where's that quote? It was like, oh, it appeared first in this. It's like a true scholars. I'm a fake one in this group, but in that sense, there's a beautiful quote of Arenas that talks about like the image not being the same at noon as it was at 2 p.m. or something like that. And then I was like, oh yeah, it appeared here, and then it was reprinted there, and I was cited from the reprint. And then, you know, when scholars are true scholars, when they kind of know it was first there. So I remember being correct in that sense. But this goes to show, I think, that what we're trying to do here is just use this sort of curriculum theory currere idea, which just means this reformulation of what a curriculum is, you know, moving to currere, which is a more active verb, you know, like a horse carriage race, and sort of use this idea, this theoretical support and pivot to a reading of Arenas in a way that makes sense to understand the continuity and the cohesion that his curriculum is about. Because curriculum in many ways is always this attempt at making things cohere for students. No? So I think that basically the spirit of the chapter was that. I hope I was clear. Because I'm the more complicated of everybody else.
That was perfect, Sandru. And I will say, I think in the book that, you know, you have all of this theory, and especially, you know, obviously that makes sense with your background. I mean, your focus is curriculum instruction and teacher education. So I think one thing that you really do, both in the book and here in our conversation, is make that more digestible. And I think honestly, as someone who has been in upper division undergraduate language courses, I think it's, you know, something really valuable for instructors, you know, wanting to teach the works of Arenas. So thank
you. And I owe that to my call because I'm not digestible at all. Most of what was helpful is that when I got too far, they pulled me back in.
You always need someone to do that. I completely understand. So the fifth chapter brings in this new figure, who's a contemporary of Arenas, who, Angela, you already mentioned, who's the Spaniard Juan Goytisolo, who is an author like Arenas, and he is of, you know, Spanish descent, but kind of like other cases, you know, obviously lots of movement between Spain and Cuba until, you know, very recently compared to other parts of Latin America. He has like ancestors that lived in Cuba. So my next question for one of you is, who was Juan Goytisolo? How is he related to Arenas? Did he know Arenas? And how is his work similar or different to that of Arenas?
Thank you. So this was another really exciting research question for us. And thank you so much for all these questions, Katie. It's clear to us that you are a fabulous reader. which is really important because Arenas demands that his readers are active. And this was actually something that I had intended to say before. I think that one of the most exciting things about his work is that you cannot read his text without wanting to go on some sort of intellectual journey. So thinking again about the notion of being a pedagogue, thinking about his notion, the notion of his being a mentor to us, his writing has taken all of us to so many other places, so many other journeys, as I was mentioning before, you know, 19th century Mexican independence writer. And here we are thinking about a Spanish writer. So some of the first times I was just reading Juan Goytisolo, who was a little bit older than Arenas. He was born in 31, Arenas in 43. I was struck with a lot of the similarities between their style, topics. They both really revel in the taboo, be it sexuality, eschatology, the underbelly of the world, being in exile. Goytisolo self-exiled from Spain under Franco. He was married, but he also had male queer lovers. He was married to a woman. So he would practice a different kind of non-binary sexuality, but they both lived on the edges. They were both very experimental. And again, with the taboo, put it in your face. I found a common thread of like kind of bathroom obsession. So just a lot of things in terms of the thematics. But what I really didn't expect to find, postmodern kind of writing as well, but what I did not expect to find were the common or the personal connections. And so I mentioned earlier on that in the Princeton Archive, there's a letter from Goytisolo to Arenas. He's talking about trying to potentially get one of Arenas' short stories, Arturo, La Estrella Más Brillante, to Almendros to make a film of it. So there, you see this kind of promotionary, I don't know if that's a word, a promotional aspect amongst their relationship. And then super interesting, as I mentioned before, we find out that they're kind of friends. And when Arenas dies, Goytisolo writes this beautiful essay as an homage to him and talks about how Arenas was in fact a mentor to him, which we found absolutely fascinating. Here we are thinking that the older Goytisolo is the mentor to Arenas, how he's helping him, trying to uplift him in his efforts to start a writing career outside of Cuba. When, as it turns out, Goytisolo states how Arenas inspired him to not be, in his words, a poser. And there's also this really hilarious kind of crude humor that they both use, the humorous scatological humor as a weapon, as an arm. And so there's this in this essay, which is called Caído en el Campo de Honor, after Arenas dies, where he talks about how Arenas wasn't one of these queers wearing, you know, fake this and fake that and fake eyelashes. He was, you know, what you see is what you get. He was authentic. He was the real deal, which has to do again with his activism, his being in your face as an activist. And then just one more like kind of textual comparison that I thought was really interesting and you seem to have to notice as well. Goytisolo, we found out, not only was his family having Cuban connections past they had a plantation, a sugarcane plantation near Cienfuegos. And like Arenas, Goytisolo rewrites history, his personal history, Spanish history, Cuban history, to R-I-G-H-T again, the past. And so we have this situation where Goytisolo finds out that his grandfather had a slave, and the slave had written a very passionate letter, basically asking for better conditions, asking for her freedom. And he puts that letter in his novel, Juan Sin Tierra, which, right, Juan without land, talking again about being an exile, the exile perspective, and parodies his own grandparents having had a plantation. So again, as Arenas had as well with Loma del Angel, we see this rewriting of history, looking at the slave perspective. So I thought that was super interesting as well. I probably have said too much. Okay, there's more to say, but we'll leave there. We'll leave it there. They both had also King Kong in their novels. Let me just say that. Go look for that.
I'm so glad you mentioned the King Kong connection. I was waiting for that. And no, that was perfect. Thank you so much. So we get to
the reader will have to actually read the text to find out, right?
Yes, okay, definitely. Bye. We always want to leave a little bit to go find out later with these podcasts. Yes. So now getting to the end of the book, on the sixth chapter, you all decide to focus on the deaths of Arenas's two most important mentors inside of Cuba, which even someone who's seen the Javier Bardem movie will recognize these names, José Lezama Lima and Virgilio Piñera. So my next question for one of you is, who were these two men? What was their relationship with Arenas like? And how did Arenas write and or speak about their deaths and the aftermath?
I'll take this once more, but I'm going to be briefer and then Sandro can jump in. Something that was super interesting to us was, besides what you've already mentioned, Katie, they were both really, really, really significant mentors to Arenas while living on the island. In Antes que Nochezca, in the introduction, Arenas even prays to Piñera's image, asking for a little bit more time to finish his work before he's planning his imminent suicide, right? So just thinking about that significance and how Piñera served as like a muse to him. What we do in the book, though, is we look at how in various texts, both essays and in one novel in particular, which was Arenas's last most significant novel, anyways, El Color del Verano. He also was finishing El Asalto at the same time. But in that novel, which he was concurrently writing with his autobiography, he represents their deaths. And for us, it was super interesting to see how the evolution of the representation of the deaths changed, or the representations evolved over time as Arenas was anticipating his own death. And so if you look at different essays again, particularly in a collection of short essays called Necesidad de Libertad, you'll see how he's complaining. He suspects that the state was involved in killing them both off in some way, shape, or form, like there was some sort of meddling. In Piñera's case, he talks over and over about how he had a supposed heart attack, and you can hear the sarcasm. That same suspicion in the novel, El Color del Verano, becomes much more hilarious. I mean, it's still terrible and tragic, but I'll just say that Piñera is killed off by a painting of a woman's vagina because he was so queer that it was terrifying for him to see such a thing that he died on the spot. So it's still the Cuban government. It's still the henchmen coming in to kill him, but the methodology is different. In Lezama Lima's case, he's most upset about the fact that he did not have a state funeral, that he wasn't really recognized as he should have been. He was a few short lines on the back page of the Granma paper rather than having the send-off that he should have had. So in, again, El Color del Verano, we see Arenas having this fantasy about young, handsome men coming out on roller skates, skateboards, throwing flowers, queer fairies at the funeral, crying, having an all night long kind of a spiritista or santería kind of a ritual commemorating his life and death. So we see perhaps hints into the way that he would like his own afterlife to be remembered by the Cuban people.
And this is some, may I jump in really
quickly? Yes, I'm done. I said a lot.
No. That I want to leave Rafa space to. I think what is interesting here is how his pedagogy is so cohesive in that way, always designing his own life despite all this crapola that happens throughout his existence. A horrible existence, a terrible existence, a terrible death at a moment where his disease was not understood in the same way that we do as well. And how life and death, which is a constant in Cuba, and whoever visits Cuba knows that you're constantly, how do I live and how do I survive? I think survival mode is something that we Latin Americans understand very well. The topsy-turvy events in our countries, the economic down, up and down, always up and down. We develop this sort of like survival anxiety, and we are always fantasizing and creating and improvising. in Cuba, you go to Cuba nowadays, you see how people improvise life in the basic necessities. How do I put together a house that is falling apart? How is it to live in ruins, these historical, beautiful mansions? And I mentioned this because part of his pedagogy is about this thing that goes back to even, Michel Foucault, which I speak very briefly in the book, and this whole idea of understanding how power works and how you always have to sort of design your own ways and constantly be destroying these old settled categories and creating new ones to bring yourself briefly outside one particular discourse, because you're always going to be speaking, from a particular discourse, right? And in that sense, I think there is a lot of kinship between what Reinaldo Arenas does with the literary craft and what others have done in, for instance, in philosophy and history, which is not a big jump, right? We are right there. And so what I think, I hope it came across in the book, is this idea of how powerful this pedagogy is of designing your own life and how you're going to be looking at life from particular moments and particular times and these various transformations that you necessarily need to do in order to survive. So this is something that I've learned with Reinaldo Arenas. And now that we are talking about it, this is like, well, I should have brought that up more in the book, but oh, well, that's the second for your second book, because Angela is working on the second book on Arenas. And so it's like, Angie, take that one.
Thank you. I'll take it.
So really kind of now that we're at the end, I really wanted to ask you all a little bit about, because this is a very unique project. It's not an edited volume. It's a text authored by three people. So I really would love to hear from, I mean, you all talked a little bit about it in the beginning, but if one or two or all of you would like to kind of give us a little bit more context on what it was like to author this text amongst the three of you.
Mm-hmm. I'll take that one. What I found very soothing was to have two other authors to experience in a way what Reinaldo must have experienced. Angie mentioned in passing that we were writing this at the peak of COVID, and it was a very humbling experience. I remember telling Sandro and Angie that as a queer man who was an adult when AIDS was at its peak in the 1980s, I felt that I was revisiting AIDS again. And actually, if I were to write something more about Reinaldo would be his fear of AIDS, for such a brave activist. Reinaldo did not, in my opinion, did not face AIDS as he had faced other calamities in his life. And so writing this book when the world was going through such a big turmoil and dealing with a subject that is very sad. Reinaldo's life, for the most part, is a very tragic life. Was a humbling experience. I am also much older than Angie and Sandro, so I was contemplating my own being old and knowing that I am closer to death than Angie and Sandra and most of our audience would be. So it was a different kind of writing, this book. And it just happened by coincidence. I don't know, maybe it was Reinaldo. We kept saying that Reinaldo was behind this book. There were so many crazy coincidences that we could point out to, almost like Reinaldo was taking care of us, that this book had to be out. And it was out in spite of the fact that we, all of a sudden, we saw ourselves without our resources. When the pandemic started, I was in San Juan. I'm Puerto Rican. I was in San Juan visiting my family. And 6 months later, I managed to come back to Atlanta, where I had all my notes on Reinaldo. So for 6 months, I was writing out of nothing, you know, for
memory.
Memory, you know, it was almost like if Reinaldo was back there dictating me stuff. Angie mentioned espiritismos. Reinaldo was very much into spiritism. So anyway, this is a crazy answer to your question that so many things happened when we were writing this book.
I think it was a beautiful collaborative experience. I just want to add that for me, it was probably one of the most meaningful experiences of my entire career. And like I said before, I found it just to be a lifeline. I learned so much from my colleagues. Like you said, Katie, even though, yes, you know, we had different roles on different chapters, all of us had equal editorial privileges. And at the beginning, we went from being worried about adding a comma or, you know, a the to like, this part is a mess, let's move this over here. And it was just a really edifying experience. I think that, again, back to the mentoring thing, it was a great educational experience, personal experience. I loved it. It was fantastic. And it made me really sad when it ended. It was almost like postpartum depression when the book ended.
Right now, talking to you guys is like the memories are coming back. I was like, I miss doing that. It gives me purpose. It made me feel not less alone. I think that literary scholars and humanities scholars in general, I come from the humanities. That's my PhD is in the Romance languages and literatures. We are very much alone when we write. And now working in this space of interstitial space between humanities and education, where education is all about collaborative and, you know, invoking citations as you, the peer pressure of the dead people, right? It's a different kind of process, a different space. But so I had to become used to people messing with my words and messing with texts. And, you know, I write as a second language, you know, writer, and Rafa is much more accustomed to English than I am. And Angie, of course, speaks it since she was born or before on the womb. And so there's these, of course, all these things like, oh, am I making myself, you know, clear? And having an audience of three, that, right, it makes it easy. You mentioned about this work of making theory digestible. That's my dream, to be able to do that in my own work in education, you know, making the highly complicated theoretical that I think is very important, digestible to audiences. So having the privilege of Rafa and Angie to read and say, what the heck are you saying here? What do you mean by query? You know, it was something very helpful to me and the kind of pedagogy that I want to do, you know, and the kinds of audiences I think that you want to speak, because like them, I love Arenas' literature. It teaches me more about history than any history book. It teaches me more about education than any educational article I've read in my life. And I don't want it to decrease the importance of other kinds of research, but it teaches me more about how to be a teacher than any article on teacher education. And it's just me, teaches me, right? So that kind of authenticity shines through his writing. And it's something that I want one day to be able to do as well and live as pedagogy.
Those are all three beautiful answers. Thank you so much. So I usually like to conclude these podcasts by asking the author, authors in our case, about, you know, what you're currently working on, any projects you have coming down the line. So I'd love to hear from all of you, you know, if you have any current projects that you'd like to share. We'd love to hear about it.
For me, I am just finished a critical anthology of the short stories and creative nonfiction essays by Judith Ortiz Cofer. Ortiz Cofer was born in Hormigueros, Puerto Rico, and at age two, she came to the United States. She was raised in Patterson, between Patterson, Georgia, Hormigueros, and as a teenager in Augusta, Georgia. She comes into the literary history books as the first Latinx writer nominated for a Pulitzer Prize the same year that Oscar Hijuelos, the Cuban-American, won for Mambo Kings. This is a project that will be published by the University Press of Georgia. And I'm also finishing a manuscript on Mexican and Argentine cinema of the mainly the 1940s and 50s that will be published by the University Press of Florida.
So, Angela and Sandro, any projects in the mix you'd like to share?
Yes, I'm actually really excited to share two things about Arenas. I have almost finished 60 something pages, probably should be about 20, an article about the Antes que Nochezca manuscript, which was concealed, hidden away in the Princeton archives since Arenas's death until very recently. And last summer I was able to go examine the manuscript and see what was omitted, what was redacted, what was changed. And so that's something that I'm very excited about and I hope to get sent off within the next week or two. So keep an eye out for that, though I need to shrink it down significantly before I do, as it's not quite in article form yet. And I also forever have been working on a book again about rewriting in Arenas's narrative. I think that that's probably his most important modus operandi in terms of one of his approaches to, again, rewriting history and rewriting literary history as well. So I'm very excited about that. And I hope to start back on that as soon as I put the finishing touches on my article. So thank you, Katie.
And Sandro.
Yeah, and I'm getting weird. I am actually about to go on sabbatical and finish a work on New Age movements' influence in education. And I particularly center in Waldorf schools and anthroposophy. You know, the anthroposophy is a movement started by Rudolf Steiner in Germany. So I'm going to be living in Germany beginning next August with my entire family and finishing this book, which I hope it's going to be interesting. It's been a sort of a interesting project that also turning to, you never imagine like how New Age movements influence entire systems of education, like or ideas, education ideas like Waldorf schools. And the kinds of literature that is sprang from that, and particular cultural practices in that sense. And I'm also with a colleague, we are also finishing a special issue on pedagogies of conspirituality. And conspirituality is this sort of a melding of conspiracy theories and the spirituality that have become popular during the pandemic, and where these social influencers, by and large, teach people about the real truth and the real history of the pandemic. So I go back to my interest in history and curriculum and sort of forms of public pedagogy and sort of try to understand that a little bit more. And those in this case are kind of quite harmful for their anti-scientific messages, but it, in many ways, it rewrites the curriculum of science that we learn in schools. And then you think like, oh, I went to school, I learned about science. How come now I think that, you know, ginger drops are going to cure my cancer, you know, or colloidal silver will resolve all my problems. But judging by the amount of businesses that these alternative practices bring, I think educators stand to gain about the tactics that social media elaborate to draw in audiences. And I can imagine like, wow, can you imagine if we teachers had that kind of ability to make, you know, the literature interesting to everybody, you know, it's just like everybody loves us. Like, what persuasion techniques are we using there? So there's something to be learned that I think can be also applicable to mainstream schools. But those are my two projects, and it gets freaky and it's delicious and it's complicated and I love it.
Okay, you can see why it's been so exciting to work with these two and why it was so traumatic when it ended. They both have taught me and the world so much.
Likewise, well, thank you.
It's so nice to, I mean, hear, so, like, this has been a really, really fabulous interview. My first interview with multiple authors. So I just want to conclude by saying that this has been the Dissidents of Renato Arenas, Queering Literature, Politics, and the Activist Curriculum. It is out from the University Press of Florida. You can get it online via their website. And so I just want to conclude now by thanking each of you, Sandro, Rafael, and Angela, for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Katie.
Thank you so much. And thank you for the University Press of Florida as well. And our wonderful Stephanie, yes. The editor who believed in us and kind of like shepherded with us this project as well. They've been terrific from the day one and giving kind of all the kinds of support that authors need to get their work out there. So it's a terrific press and the experience has been lovely as well from that end.
And lots of great Latin American Cuba books, including one, it sounds like, coming from Rafael Ocasio here with us today. So thank you once again to all three of you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.